came across to some listeners as shouting or strident. It was a gender-loaded complaint, but one she had to deal with in rallying her own troops and trying to persuade undecided voters to join her side. As she practiced, her tone had urgency. But Sheehan wanted her to slow it down, to anticipate the audience and pause for applause lines. He also told her that she should lower her voice rather than raise it at important moments. It was a technique Bill had perfected, quieting down so that an audience had to lean in to hear what he was saying. That, Sheehan explained, would give more power to her words. It was the way to put listeners in the palm of her hand. Perhaps the most important insight he gave her, though, had to do with her expression. Too often, she didn't have one. She didn't look like she was having any fun. This speech, the convention, and the entire campaign were a show, and the performance aspect didn't come naturally to Hillary. Smile, Sheehan reminded her. With a few final tweaks, the final draft was ready to go at 9 p.m., more than an hour before Hillary would take the stage. As she waited for her big moment, an unlikely Democratic Party hero was emerging at the Wells Fargo Center. No one knew ahead of time that the person who would steal the show at the convention wasn't Clinton herself, or her husband, or the man she hoped to replace at the White House. Instead, it was Khazir Khan, a Muslim Gold Star father whose son had been killed in the Iraq War. The campaign had put together a long roster of what might be considered regular Americans to illustrate certain arguments for Hillary or against Trump. Mook thought the most powerful of that set would be a woman who used a death benefit from her husband to attend the much-maligned Trump University. Khan had first become a feature of the campaign in a much more modest fashion in December 2015, when Hillary called attention to his family in a speech in Minnesota, right after Khan had bashed Trump in a story in Vocative. She had referred to his son, Humayun, as the best of America. For convention purposes, Khazir Khan was considered a second-tier player, according to one Hillary aide. That is, until he began speaking. Bald, bespectacled, and grim-faced, Khan took Trump to task for anti-immigrant policies, particularly a proposed temporary ban on Muslims traveling to the United States. With his wife standing beside him, Khan pulled a copy of the Constitution out of his pocket, brandishing it as he lectured Trump from the podium. "Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy," the Pakistani-born lawyer boomed as the crowd in the convention hall cheered. "Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of the brave patriots who died defending the United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities." Then Khan made it more personal. "You have sacrificed nothing and no one," he lectured, pitching his body forward and jabbing his index finger toward the camera to punctuate his words. Hillary watched in amazement from her holding room backstage. Democrats in the hall and around the country exulted in the powerful illustration of their values and the shaming of Trump. Most Republicans immediately grasped the value of the moment. "Whoever found the cons should be an ambassador to something," one senior GOP official said after the convention. Khan's conclusion that Trump had sacrificed nothing in his life tied perfectly into the major contrast point Hillary hoped to draw with the most full explication to date of the twining of her values, the party's values, the nation's values, and her record of public service. She and her speechwriters were very mindful of the idea that no matter how long she had been in the public eye, she had still not effectively explained to voters how her life story fit into their ideals of America. The speeches delivered by Bill and Chelsea Clinton during the convention had a single aim, to help voters understand Clinton at a time when she was drowning in the polls on the issue of likability. "People don't know who my mom is, and I want to speak to that," Chelsea had told Rooney in the early summer when they started working on Chelsea's remarks that would lead into Hillary's acceptance of the nomination. She knew she had a unique perspective on her mother, and the lineage of women from her grandmother to Chelsea herself was an important, if underappreciated, aspect of Hillary's narrative. Lots of people spoke about Hillary's resilience, but very few of them had a front-row seat to it. "I saw the tough times," Chelsea told Rooney. The two of them emailed thoughts over the course of the summer, and Rooney found that Chelsea was ruthlessly accurate about the details of her childhood. When Rooney tried to gloss over an anecdote about Chelsea's parents asking her about her day at the dinner table before they discussed their own days, Chelsea objected. "No," she said, "this is telling about my mom." During the convention, Rooney had visited Chelsea in her suite. As Chelsea nursed her infant son, Aiden, and asked her daughter, Charlotte, whether she wanted agua, Clinton and her husband, Mark Mezvinsky, were raising their kids to be bilingual, they went over the final edits. Chelsea would do her best to humanize her mom, just as both Obamas, Bill Clinton, Joe Biden, and others had done over the course of the four-day convention. It was up to Chelsea to soften up the audience for her mother's biggest political moment yet. Standing in a retrofitted locker room backstage that served as her holding area, Hillary beamed with pride when Chelsea appeared on a flat-screen television. Her personal photographer, Barbara Kinney, snapped a quick shot of mom watching daughter and then left the room. In the final moments before her own historic speech, Hillary was left in solitude. When Chelsea announced her mom to a thunderous roar from the convention hall, Hillary stepped into public view for the first time that night, wearing a white suit that seemed to scream, "I'm pure of heart," an homage to suffragists who wore white to symbolize the sanctity of their purpose. As Hillary embraced Chelsea, the emotional crest of the moment hit her hard. Decades of battling at the highest levels of public life, two presidential primary campaigns, her role as the first woman ever nominated by a major party, and her love for Chelsea washed over her. With her campaign anthem, Fight Song, blaring in the background, Hillary walked across the stage, waving to the crowd, pointing to friends in the first few rows on the floor, and mouthing, "Oh my gosh." She looked as happy and confident as she had at any point in the campaign, and to her close friends, a bit overwhelmed. As she finally stepped toward the podium, her hand rested over her heart. Now Hillary would have another chance, perhaps her last chance, to persuade voters that what Chelsea Clinton said was true, that despite public perception, she really did wake up every morning trying to figure out how to fight for other people. The party's leaders had all lent their credibility to her cause in the preceding 3 days, and she thanked them for it, even Sanders, who wore a disgusted look in a skybox above the convention floor. He'd had a shot and he'd missed, and now he had to listen to Hillary Clinton's generated graciousness. The scowl on his face read as though it grated on him, and the whole idea of Hillary infuriated many of his supporters who were still in the hall. Throughout her speech, pockets of die-hard Bernie backers screamed slogans at the stage. Each time, the joint Clinton-Sanders whip team jumped into action, and chants of USA drowned out the dissidents. Recalcitrant Bernie supporters who left the hall to get a soda or go to the bathroom found that their seats had been occupied by pro-Clinton forces when they returned. Schwerin, Rooney, and Sullivan had tailored the speech with the aim of including a lot of applause lines, fearful that any lulls would encourage outbursts from the pro-Bernie delegates. They had reassured Hillary that there would be plenty of cheering to cover up any dissent. It turned out to be a prescient concern. The interruptions were more disruptive in the hall than they seemed at home, and several of Hillary's longtime advisors said that the cadence of her delivery was thrown off. Schwerin, who had walked into the audience to watch the speech, was annoyed by the distractions. So was Rooney, who sat in a family section up front. They worried that all of it, the protests and the oddly timed cheers engineered by the campaign floor operation to stifle dissent, would translate on television and take the air out of Hillary's acceptance. There was nothing they could do but hope that it would come off better to the home audience than it did inside the Wells Fargo Center. Hillary picked her way through the beginning of the speech. She sounded out the notes that she and her small army of speechwriters had prioritized. And then she turned personal, leaning on words drafted by Muscatine, who had been her first speechwriter. "I've been your first lady. Served 8 years as a senator from the great state of New York. I ran for president and lost. Then I represented all of you as Secretary of State. But my job titles only tell you what I've done. They don't tell you why," Hillary said. "The truth is, through all these years of public service, the service part has always come easier to me than the public part." It was an acknowledgement, however subtle, of her guardedness, of her reluctance to keep opening her armor to absorb the arrows of public life. Though she didn't mention the email server, her words were a nod to a frustration that many Democrats shared with her Republican critics about her lack of transparency. She talked about her mother's influence on her and her Methodist faith, about how she learned as a young activist that it takes a lot of hard work to alter the political landscape. To drive real progress, you have to change both hearts and laws, she said. As much as anything she said on the campaign trail, that one sentence explained Hillary's strength and weakness in the public sphere. She wasn't good at the former, so she concentrated on the latter. One of the toughest moments of the 2008 primary campaign for her came when she had accused Obama of using flowery words without having the record to back up his promises. Obama used her formulation, just words, to compare himself to Martin Luther King, Jr. Hillary had countered by noting that King wouldn't have won civil rights legislation without Lyndon Johnson working the system from the inside in the Senate and the White House. It had been received as a knock on King, but it was a clear-eyed distillation of the yin and yang of outside activism and inside power. In her Philadelphia speech, Hillary tipped her cap to the civil rights and labor movements, saying to Donald Trump, "We are not afraid." The hook of the fourth stanza in We Shall Overcome. A substantial portion of her address was devoted to knocking down Trump, and she hit the most memorable line of the night about baiting Trump with a tweet right out of the park. Like most of her major speeches, though, Hillary tried to squeeze in too many ideas. It remained impossible to decipher her priorities or her theory for her candidacy. "She genuinely cares about a ton of different things," said one aide. "She has plans for a ton of different things. It's hard to come up with the three things." Additionally, the aide said, nominees' convention speeches are famous for being stocked with too many ideas. "As a form, it's a tough speech," said the aide, who rated it solid. She foundered at the end with a sappy wrap-up that borrowed from the musical Hamilton, a production that connected with her liberal donors and cosmopolitan millennial aides, but perhaps not the rest of the country. It was Kennedy who had come up with the Hamilton line, and Hillary, who had seen the show twice, had immediately fawned over it. There was no use in trying to talk her out of it, even though several speechwriters involved in the process thought it was the wrong message to send. One of the clearest lines of distinction between a great political speech and a pedestrian one is the ability of the speaker to turn the peroration, the final run, into a big call for action. Hillary's fell flat. Her prose speechwriters knew it would. They tried to save her from being hokey and timid, but she'd ignored them. America's destiny is ours to choose. So let's be stronger together, she said, repeating her slogan. Looking to the future with courage and confidence, building a better tomorrow for our beloved children and our beloved country. When we do, America will be greater than ever. One person who worked on the speech summed up the consensus within Democratic ranks. Her delivery was better than it usually is. But Hillary was in a celebratory mood backstage. On cloud nine, one of her aides said. Given what the convention could have been, a four-day dumpster inferno, Democrats rated it as a rousing success, with some going so far as to say it was the best in recent memory. Just a few days earlier, the party chairwoman had been ousted without ceremony. Hillary's speech had been rescued from the jaws of disaster and turned into an effective, if uninspiring, contrast with Trump. And the many Bernie delegates who had come to the convention determined to disrupt it with shows of disdain for Hillary had run into a unified phalanx of Sanders and Clinton aides even more committed to shutting them down. Over their text messaging system, those aides congratulated one another after all was said and done. They knew all too well that they had narrowly averted the catastrophe of television cameras around the country showing a party still riven by its brutal primary. Despite the fact that sometimes it got contentious, we always figured it out, and we all wanted the same goal overall, Marlon Marshall wrote. Nothing like a little skirmish to make folks a family, Charlie Baker replied. Bernie advisor Mark Longabaugh weighed in for the Sanders camp. The disagreements were passionate, but always in good faith, he wrote. In the end, one of the best conventions in history. Now, on to victory in November. Mook was most keenly aware of the optical illusion the two camps had pulled off, as he revealed to friends in a story he would tell later. During the convention, a woman approached him and said that the American flags in the arena were beautiful. That was to hide the crazy people shouting things, he thought. But it looked great. Similarly, the campaign looked a lot better in front of the curtain than behind it. Chapter 16. It's so phony. Hillary mingled with old friends in Sag Harbor under a tent on the night of August 30th. Calvin Klein, Harvey Weinstein, Jimmy Buffett, John Bon Jovi, and Sir Paul McCartney. Buffett and his wife, Jane, were the hosts of this extravaganza, which capped a multi-day fundraising blitz through the Hamptons. For a minimum of $100,000, VIPs were treated to dinner, premium seating, and the option to dance the night away with Hillary, Bill, and a few of their A-list pals. Hillary put on a brave face, reveled with her donors, and even joined in singing Hey Jude. But, below the surface, she was tense. Her closest aide's personal life was blowing up in a fashion so spectacular that the campaign was at risk of becoming collateral damage. It was a day that was very trying because Huma had to go back and deal with the latest crisis, said one friend. 48 hours earlier, the New York Post had reported that Abedin's husband, Anthony Weiner, had not only resumed sexting other women, but published a photo he had taken of himself clad only in underwear, with the couple's young son sleeping in the bed next to him. Years earlier, when Wiener's first sexting scandal erupted, Hillary had told her closest aide that she had some big decisions to make. Huma had opted to stay with Wiener, both then and when new revelations of his lewd texting had surfaced during his 2013 mayoral run. Huma viewed her husband as a good parent and a necessary partner in caring for their son while she traveled with Hillary. But this time was different. It wasn't just his own political career that he'd put in jeopardy. His exploits were now a problem for Hillary because Abedin was so close to her. Abedin announced the day before the Buffett fundraiser and the day after the news broke that she was separating from Wiener, and she dropped off the campaign to go home and be with her son. "I think I shouldn't come with you guys for a few days," she told colleagues, preempting an uncomfortable internal conversation about whether she should be photographed by Hillary's side while her family life was imploding. "All of us saw that she was a liability," the friend said. But Abedin was Hillary's intimate, the right-hand aide who anticipated her needs, followed up on her promises, and handled sensitive political and personal issues with discretion and grace. One longtime advisor explained the candidate's fidelity to her aide this way: "Some of it is sheer loyalty, some of it is empathy." But the Huma storyline had begun to get old for staffers on the campaign who felt like she not only had a firm hold on access to Hillary, but also involved herself in making decisions outside her purview. "Everybody wants access, and she's always around, and what happens is you have her speaking for HRC at times," said one colleague, "making decisions she shouldn't have been, or simply playing just a protective role. That gets read as she's trying to hold on to her power." Separately, with her Vogue centerpieces and her participation in a revealing documentary on Wiener's mayoral bid, Abedin had broken the old political rule that aides should never overshadow their bosses. The newest Wiener fiasco was a double blow to Hillary, a painful episode for the woman closest to her, and a political bombshell that could cost her in the campaign. It was also yet another subtle reminder for the public of Bill's infidelity. The sexually salacious headlines came at a terrible time for Hillary, in the midst of a slide in the polls that erased her convention bounce. "I think she wished that Huma had left Anthony earlier," the friend said, "but she would not have imposed." 3 weeks earlier, after the Democratic convention and at the tail end of a national jobs tour, Hillary's lead had jumped. On August 9th, it stood at 7.9 points in the Real Clear Politics average of public polls. She was enjoying the afterglow of the Democrats' show of unity at their convention, and Donald Trump's decision to attack Khazir Khan and his wife after it. She and her team felt good about getting some separation, but the numbers also should have been a red flag. After pouring tens of millions of dollars into the states, watching Trump insult nearly every imaginable group other than white men, and pulling off a convention that could easily have melted down, the Republican nominee was still well within striking distance. The failure to put Trump away would become all the more apparent as Hillary's advantage evaporated over the next 6 weeks. The back end of August had always been viewed as a sweet spot in the calendar for Hillary to stock her campaign treasury. She hadn't raised money for the general election in the throes of her primary with Bernie Sanders, a lesson learned from 2008 when she'd piled up cash that she couldn't legally use in her contest against Obama. June and July had been devoted to campaigning and preparation for the convention. After Labor Day, she'd be in a dead sprint to the election. So, with an overall fundraising goal for the campaign of $1 billion, August represented her last, best chance to collect six-figure checks from high-touch donors, the kind of contributors who expected real face time for real money. Hillary didn't love fundraising, but she understood that she relied more on the wealthiest donors than did passion candidates like Sanders and Obama, who could use digital and grassroots fundraising techniques to fill their coffers. And she knew her contributors, in particular, needed a lot of hand-holding. She shared with Mook a fear of plunging into debt, another residual effect of the 2008 campaign. For the campaign manager, rebalancing his candidate's schedule to do more fundraising and fewer swing state rallies constituted a necessary evil. He felt that he and Hillary were alone in the view that the campaign didn't have enough cash, a function, in part, of the fact that he didn't always share detailed budget information with other campaign officials. But it was also a telling feeling, given how much less Trump was putting into his campaign. Mook had much more money to spend, but the cost of running Hillary's campaign was high. She'd spent $37 million to Trump's $18 million in July, and she had $58.5 million in the bank, $20 million more than Trump, according to Bloomberg. Yet at the end of August, she would have 800 paid staff, compared with 130 for Trump. At the same time, the low-spending Trump was starting to rake in contributions at a pace, $80 million in July alone, that grabbed the Clinton campaign's attention. So Hillary was both extremely well-funded in comparison to her opponent and nervous that she wouldn't have enough money to sustain her campaign. This combination of being flush with cash but phobic about expenses put a hammerlock on Mook's budget, and it guided his decision-making. Early on in the general campaign, he'd given some of his state directors money to play with, and, from his perspective, they'd burned through it with the expectation that more was coming. He was constantly turning down requests for more paid staff in the states. "You don't understand how big our payroll is now," he thought each time one of the flock complained that his fists were wrapped too tightly around the campaign's cash. "This is an Obama problem," he thought, remembering how freely the 2012 campaign had spent money. So many of Hillary's field operatives had worked on that bid, and they expected this one to be as well funded. Hillary had built a massive operation with an insatiable appetite for cash. Trump's leaner beast was fed with relatively small morsels from his personal treasury and contributors, and he still was trailing by only single digits. Mook was surprised that Trump and Republican super PACs hadn't flooded the airwaves with ads during the summer, but he couldn't count on that to continue. Sending Hillary to posh fundraisers like the Buffett affair in the Hamptons was the function of a simple truth, said one person familiar with his strategy. "We didn't have the money." "It was harder for Hillary to raise money," this person said, "because people thought we were going to win." Mook was confident enough in that prospect that he had begun to tentatively explore the possibility of taking over at the DNC after the election, a move that gained no traction because of the number and clout of his critics in Clinton world. With regard to the donors, it was harder to get them to take action when things were going well, said one person familiar with her fundraising operation. "The times that people thought she was losing or something challenging happened, that's when people would rally behind her." That was the opposite of the experience of many political candidates, including Obama, who could raise cash off their successes. The problem cut in both directions. Small-dollar donors didn't think Hillary needed their contributions, and, with the exception of her longtime friends, the elites who could bundle hundreds of thousands of dollars believed that they could never give enough to get truly close to her. You have people who have known her forever, who believe she walks on water, she can do no wrong, said one donor who became disillusioned during the campaign. They work hard. They get invited to all the cool stuff. But for all the new people that have come on board recently, they're going to events, but there's nothing special being done for them. So Hillary carved out time in August to visit the moneyed set in the elite East Coast summer destinations of Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, and the Hamptons. The new infusion of cash would help fund her operations through the remainder of the campaign, but not the extra resources that her state directors thought she so desperately needed to compete with Trump on the ground in the most important battlefields. Early one morning at the beginning of August, Emmy Ruiz fielded a troubling phone call from Allison Zellman, Brooklyn's regional director for a handful of battleground states, including Colorado, Nevada, and Florida. Ruiz, who engineered Hillary's caucus victory in Nevada in February, had since moved to Colorado to set up the general election campaign there. She thought of herself as a storm chaser, a state-level specialist who had delivered against the odds for Hillary and Obama, and she relished a shot at taking a state that had voted twice for Obama and twice for George W. Bush. From the very start, though, Ruiz viewed Colorado as a tough challenge for Hillary. To win, she thought, Hillary would need a full court press, complete with significant spending on television ads. But Brooklyn didn't see it that way. The campaign would be taking a break, Zellman said. There would be no television advertising. WTF, Ruiz thought. Hillary was up in Colorado, but only by half a dozen points, and Trump clearly intended to compete heavily there. He'd appeared in the state twice in July. It felt like he was closing ground. Easing off the gas in a true swing state didn't make much sense from Ruiz's perspective on the front lines. She pushed back a little bit. You want to do it, go for it, Ruiz replied. But what you're saying is that you're okay with putting all your eggs in one basket, and I hope you're not wrong. Zellman, who had worked as the field director for Obama's 2012 campaign in Pennsylvania, said Mook was making the right move based on the analytics. Reviewing Elon Kriegel's data and having watched Trump cruise through the primaries on the power of Twitter and free coverage from news outlets, Mook came to believe that television ads were less effective in 2016 than they had been in any previous cycle. As he did in Colorado, he directed spending in other battleground states based on what was most efficient, with little regard for the possibility that allocating resources to less efficient methods of reaching voters could also work to build Hillary's coalition. Brooklyn had reeled back advertising in both Colorado and Virginia at the same time. It was expensive to run TV ads in Denver and the D.C. market that reached Democratic-rich northern Virginia suburbs. Trump wasn't on the air, and neither were Republican super PACs. The view of Mook and his paid media guru, Orrin Schur, was that the electorate in both states was tailored well for Hillary to win. Significant minority populations, and a high number of college-educated voters. The genetic makeup of the states was beneficial to us, said one aide familiar with the rationale for pulling back on television spending. The anxiety over money had driven so many decisions, including tailoring primary campaigns to win just enough votes and delegates for Hillary to take a commanding lead, without spending extra to convert Bernie supporters and undecided voters. Mook's plan for the primaries had worked. Hillary won the nomination, and she did it even as Bernie raised more money than she did during a crucial period in the spring. But on another level, Bernie's resilience and his appeal to groups that didn't find Hillary inspiring, working-class whites and millennials, had damaged her badly. Had she fought harder for those voters, she might have dispatched Bernie earlier and saved herself some of the pain of a long, divisive primary. That, in essence, was what Bill Clinton and the older set within the campaign were arguing for during the early months. More contact with voters outside the demographic wheelhouse that created the safest path to winning the nomination. During the primaries, Mook's obsession with efficiency had come at the cost of broad voter contact in states that would become important battlegrounds in the general election. It led him to send the Clintons to big cities where Black and Latino voters would produce major delegate halls. Putting Hillary in Detroit, for example, was the most efficient way of building votes for the primary and the general election, but it meant that she wasn't in mostly white Macomb County, just outside the city. "If you're a white voter in Macomb County, that means something," said one high-ranking campaign aide. Some of Hillary's top brass would eventually theorize that this was a major difference between Hillary and Obama. White voters punished her for running a campaign so focused on minority voters, whereas Obama was able to spend time in the white-heavy suburbs of major cities without alienating his African-American base. Mook was giving up on persuading voters who weren't inclined to support Hillary because it was less efficient to go after them. "It's hard if you try. It's even harder if you don't try," one senior aide said of the decision to forego appearances in white suburbs. "This is where the analytics can mislead you." A couple of weeks after that first phone call with Ruiz, Zelman sent word of even deeper cuts. The campaign wouldn't spend money on direct mail or digital advertising in Colorado. The former was one of the best ways to reach older voters, and digital was the key to a millennial constituency that didn't like Trump, but was very open to voting for a third-party candidate. Taken together, the decisions to go without television, direct mail, or digital advertising amounted to a judgment from Brooklyn that the campaign should focus on turning out supporters rather than trying to persuade fence sitters. Brooklyn had provided Ruiz with warm bodies. The Colorado field force would number 245. But how was she supposed to win without protection? "You guys are sending me into war without armor," she complained. At one level, as Mook understood, it was the job of a state director to ask for more resources, and his role to allocate them with a view to the national playing field. But similar conversations were playing out across the dozen or so battlegrounds. Mook felt like he had a limited budget to play with, so it made sense to him to spend on the programs he thought were most efficient and in the states where the campaign needed the most firepower. Hillary was in better shape in Colorado than she was in other states. Ruiz would have to do without. But the decision was deeply unsettling to her. It felt like Brooklyn was taking Colorado for granted, and she believed the race was too volatile for that. Whatever the analytics showed, Ruiz's political tuner told her that Trump was gaining ground on Hillary. That fear had actually heightened through August, just as the campaign's leadership was paring its operation. Hillary had spent $52 million on general election TV ads, supplemented by another $37 million from supportive outside groups by August 9th, according to advertising analytics. Trump hadn't paid for a single spot at that point. And while Hillary's post-convention rise in the polls had peaked at 7.9 points on that same day, she hadn't been able to shake her rival. Now, just as she had extended her lead, it felt like Hillary was easing back. She was working the fundraising circuit hard, but for the public and for her own staffers in the states, she had all but vanished from view. And she had done so at precisely the moment that Trump was starting to rev his engine. It wasn't just the crew in the states that questioned Mook's methods. In Brooklyn, Podesta had complained with increasing irritation over the course of the campaign that Mook wasn't sharing information with him. Podesta gravitated toward the older set of a generational divide within the campaign that thought the young campaign manager was too driven by data and ignored the advice he got from more experienced hands. For his part, Mook thought Podesta only wanted to deal with issues that interested him and couldn't be nailed down to sign off on strategic or tactical decisions. Podesta, whose temper had earned him the alter ego nickname Skippy during Bill Clinton's presidency, would rant and call Mook names. And to his credit, he did it to Mook's face. The campaign chairman, ostensibly the steady guiding hand, created the old school drama that Mook had been instructed to eradicate from Hillary's operation. In short, Mook thought Podesta was a dick. It was all terribly confusing for their lieutenants, who couldn't figure out which man's orders to follow, or in some cases, picked the instructions they preferred. Hillary had heard the complaints, and she had added Minion Moore to the mix in the spring, in part to break up some of the silos. The Super Six construct had eased some of the tension, but not all of it. The decision-by-committee approach only worked if all the issues facing the campaign were aired and discussed openly by the group, and Mook, who had adroitly managed Hillary in sidelining rivals and putting on a show of hiring more field organizers during the primaries, continued to guard potentially negative information from colleagues who felt a responsibility to act as a check on his decisions. Robbie's a person whose style was to try to work out a solution to the problem before he says there is a problem, said one highly placed official. Back in June, at a senior staff retreat in upstate New York, Mook gave a presentation intended to make it clear to everyone who was responsible for what and how the campaign leadership could operate more smoothly. He asked for commitments that meetings would start on time, that everyone would show up promptly, and that there would be a clear purpose for each meeting. For those who knew the precisionist Mook well, these weren't unreasonable or surprising requests. On previous campaigns, he'd run meetings with a whiteboard at his fingertips and was absolutely anal about every meeting ending with action items. As Michael Halley, who would go on to serve as Hillary's director of battleground analytics and strategy, put it in a 2014 profile of Mook. When it was Podesta's turn to talk, he cut to the chase. Robbie is passive-aggressive, he said in front of Mook and everyone on the campaign's leadership team. I'm merely aggressive. That Podesta felt that way was not a surprise, nor was he alone. Mook's tight control over information infuriated other senior campaign officials. That Podesta would voice those frustrations so boldly and unapologetically in a room full of top aides was stunning. Even more so was the fact that the fight didn't leak to the press. It is a testament to how much people really sincerely loved and cared about Hillary that a lot of this was not made public, said one person who watched the exchange and thought Podesta was right about Mook. There were a lot of issues and challenges and frustrations that weren't aired out of loyalty to her, and that benefited him. The relationship between Hillary's baby boomer chairman and her millennial-style manager would remain fraught throughout the campaign. It mattered, because Podesta didn't always have a window into the strategy and tactics guiding Mook's decisions. The campaign chairman, who should have been in a position to raise red flags, didn't feel like he had enough information to do that. The practical implications of the dysfunction at the top of the campaign were felt throughout the ranks. Because she couldn't risk alienating Bernie's voters, Hillary had waited as long as possible to start running her general election campaign. For veterans of Obama's 2012 campaign, the calendar was condensed. We had to put together a massive national organization, and we had to do it in 3 or 4 months between June and Labor Day, said one Brooklyn official, who noted that the internal power tussle complicated those efforts. It was a campaign in which no one ever had full authority on anything. So in order to implement something, it required getting the buy-in from multiple people. The delays compounded the challenge presented by building all of those state-level organizations at once. And Mook's strategy called for playing in every competitive state and trying to create opportunities where they hadn't existed before. One aide described the way Brooklyn looked at acquiring the 270 electoral votes needed to win this way. Put as many options as possible on the table. If something does go wrong, we want to be competitive in a lot of places. As far back as December 2015, when he disagreed with Jen O'Malley Dillon over the strategy for the general election, Mook had identified 9 traditional battleground states and 6 watch states: Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Oregon, Maine, and New Mexico, that leaned Democratic, but that the campaign should keep its eye on. By August, Mook, Marshall, and Battleground States Director Meg Ansara were starting to look at the map and the allocation of resources differently. The analytics suggested Hillary wasn't likely to win in Ohio or Iowa, but the imperative to avoid signaling this to the press and the public drove some of the decision-making. That is, they kept real campaigns going in those states just to keep up the appearance that they were competitive. If we had pulled back in Ohio or Iowa in August, the official said, we would have been killed on that. So I think the decisions we were facing, maybe we should have. But at the time, with the information we had, it was the right decision. Ohio and Iowa would have been delicious cherries on top of a victory sundae. But in Kriegel's rank order of states necessary for Hillary to hit the magic number of 270, they were just that. Throughout the campaign, and in a variety of iterations and combinations, Mook identified 3 keystone states that would pave the path for Hillary's victory: Pennsylvania, Florida, and North Carolina. What analytics did for us is give us the path of least resistance. It told us what the most likely scenarios were for winning and losing, said one Mook ally. We knew path 1 was Florida, path 2 was Pennsylvania and the Midwest, path 3 was North Carolina and New Hampshire and Nevada. All of those scenarios assumed Hillary would win the big 10 states of Michigan and Wisconsin. On the other side, Trump was focused intently on a Rust Belt strategy that would drive into Democratic-leaning territory. While Florida and North Carolina are outside that region, he would also need them to win. As Trump would later confide to a top Democratic official soon after the election, he targeted the upper Midwest in the general election because he saw the hostility there. While Hillary was out raising money in the summer enclaves of the rich and powerful, Trump was serving up red meat to angry voters across the country. At the same time, Brooklyn was fighting over lines of authority, and Hillary's state directors were begging for relief from the diktats of analytics. As she began speaking at a Labor Day rally in Cleveland on September 5th, Hillary suffered through an epic coughing fit. She had been having such episodes for weeks, but she tried to laugh it off. "Every time I think about Trump, I get allergic," she joked to the crowd. But there was a more serious political dynamic at play. While she had been raising money in August, Trump had attacked her for not having the mental and physical stamina for the presidency. Some of her allies thought it was a sexist line of argument. As a woman, she wasn't tough enough to hack it, he seemed to be saying. And yet, Obama had worried that she was pushing herself too hard when he'd seen her at the convention. Either way, her struggle to get through the Cleveland speech played right into Trump's hands. The coughing fit happened at an inauspicious moment for Hillary. For most of the campaign, She had assiduously avoided direct encounters with the national media, going so far as to have aides move a rope to wall them off from her while she walked in a New Hampshire 4th of July parade in 2015. Labor Day 2016 was the first time her traveling press corps was allowed to fly on her plane. When she went back to chat with them after the Cleveland rally, she was overcome with another coughing fit. Once she recovered, she was, of course, asked whether there was anything to Republican claims that her health had faltered. "I'm not concerned about the conspiracy theories," she said. "I pay no attention to them." But this wasn't a conspiracy theory. Even some of her staff members wondered what was wrong with her. One aide who had traveled with her over the previous several weeks could tell that Hillary was fighting an illness. "This woman is coughing a lot," the aide thought. "Clearly, she needs antibiotics." But the aide didn't raise any concerns. Not only was Hillary feeling run down, but Trump had virtually eclipsed her for a month, combining the free media tools he'd used so well in the primaries, Twitter and big nationally televised rallies, with a new advertising blitz. Over the course of less than 4 weeks, he slashed her 7.9-point post-convention advantage to 3.2 points nationally. She was sucking wind politically, and both her political standing and her physical standing were about to take much bigger hits. The former came first at an LGBT gala for the Hillary Victory Fund in New York on Friday, September 9th. For a couple of weeks, Hillary had been sharpening her rhetoric against not just Trump, but his supporters. Megan Rooney, a talented young speechwriter who had been with her at State and had penned speeches for Obama in the White House, provided the prose that sought to frame Trump as the leader of a movement far outside the mainstream of American politics. In late August, in one of her few notable public appearances, Hillary had gone off on the alt-right, a group of largely white nationalist conservatives who gravitated to the Breitbart website long run by the new CEO of Trump's campaign, Steve Bannon. It was an escalation from a similarly pugnacious speech, also written by Rooney, that Hillary had given toward the end of the primaries, in which she had portrayed Trump as temperamentally unfit for the presidency. Back then, her policy and speechwriting team felt that they had solved a puzzle that had bedeviled the GOP field. They would use Trump's words and those of his top allies to show that he shouldn't be commander-in-chief. At the beginning of that speechwriting process, Rooney had started with a contrast about Hillary's values and working with allies. But Jim Steinberg, who had served as a deputy secretary of state under Hillary and who was advising her policy team, said Rooney was looking at it wrong. It was true that Trump said a lot of things that would upend traditional establishment foreign policy thinking. He wanted to abolish NATO, talked about keeping nuclear war on the table, and had a soft spot for Russian President Vladimir Putin, among other things. But Steinberg said the main focus should be on Trump being erratic. Everything else, he argued, was less important. The speech had been extremely well received by a Democratic Party establishment that was anxious to see Hillary prove that she could be tough on Trump at the end of a brutal primary with Bernie Sanders. The alt-right speech pushed past Trump and into the guts of his movement. The plain aim was to convince the establishment Republicans who had opposed Trump in his primary that backing him now would put them on the side of the bigots at the fringe of their party. She read off a series of headlines from Breitbart News, including, "Would you rather your child had feminism or cancer?" and "Hoist it high and proud, the Confederate flag proclaims a glorious heritage." "This is not conservatism as we have known it," said Hillary, who had been a conservative supporter of Barry Goldwater as a high school student in 1964. "This is not Republicanism as we have known it. These are race-baiting ideas, anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant ideas, anti-woman, all key tenets making up an emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right. In private, she would go further, referring to Trump's most ardent backers as deplorables. All the while, she maintained in public, as she did in the alt-right speech, that she wanted to be a president for all Americans. Her private thoughts collided with her public statements, and her rhetoric about being a president for everyone with her chatter about the deplorability of Trump activists at the LGBT Victory Fund gala. Unaware that the media had been brought in to cover her remarks, she'd grown accustomed to fundraising events that were closed to the press. She opened up on Trump's backers. You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables, she said. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And unfortunately, there are people like that. She added that they were irredeemable. The reaction to her remarks, so starkly at odds with her Stronger Together slogan, was swift and severe. That night, conservatives began using hashtag basket of deplorables to rally critics of Hillary, and Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence said at a conference in Washington the next day that Americans are not a basket of anything. Hillary's traveling spokesman, Nick Merrill, initially tried to play down the remarks as part of the larger argument she'd been making about Trump's giving voice to bigots. But as night turned to morning, Hillary's advisors decided they needed a better plan, and quick. On an early Saturday morning conference call, they discussed whether and how Hillary should walk it back. The group decided to put out a half-apology immediately. Last night, I was grossly generalistic, and that's never a good idea, Hillary said in a statement. I regret saying half. That was wrong. For a campaign staff that sometimes deliberated over the content of tweets for hours on end, the speedy resolution was a moment of clarity and alacrity. One Clinton aide later said the snappy decision-making was one of our finest moments internally. But others thought it didn't do enough to limit the damage Hillary had done to herself. They knew they were witnessing their first unforced error of the fall, and it was ugly. It was like, oh my God, one campaign staffer said of his reaction to her original comment. She didn't have the feel, the empathy. Hillary had become the 2016 cycle's Mitt Romney. Back in 2012, he'd been caught on tape saying that he didn't worry about the 47% of Americans who depended on government and that he would never convince them they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives. Romney's cavalier commentary on such a large portion of the American electorate had cast him as out of touch with regular folks, including many Republicans and independents who benefited from direct government assistance. For all the messaging she'd done on inclusiveness, she now sounded like not only an elite, but an elitist. If nothing else, she'd energized an already active Trump base. And still, things were about to get worse. Earlier that day, Hillary's doctor had diagnosed her with pneumonia, which explained her cough. But most of the leadership of her campaign was kept in the dark about it. Of the Super Six, only Abedin knew. As a result, the media wasn't informed about a significant change in the Democratic presidential nominee's health, an omission that would be costly. Hillary had been advised by her doctor to take it easy, but she participated without incident in a debate prep session in Westchester the next day, and insisted on attending a September 11th memorial service in Manhattan that Sunday. She had represented the state in the Senate during and after the terrorist assault that felled the Twin Towers and killed nearly 3,000 of her fellow New Yorkers in 2001. She was particularly proud of the work she'd done to win federal funding to benefit first responders. During the service, Hillary began to feel overheated and faint. She walked away from the event and toward a waiting van with the assistance of an aide. As she moved to get into the van, her body pitched and slumped. She was dragged the last couple of feet into the vehicle, with her feet scraping across the curb. Her campaign initially said nothing and didn't even alert her traveling press pool of reporters that she would be leaving early. The media learned of Hillary's departure when video of her being hoisted into the van surfaced online. For the next couple of hours, in the absence of any clarifying information from the campaign, media outlets played the video over and over, and pundits, both professional and amateur, speculated on social media about whether she was suffering from a serious health problem. Kane emailed to check on her soon after the video began playing on television, and she responded that she was fine. He hadn't been told of the pneumonia diagnosis either. Between Trump suggesting she didn't have the stamina to be president, Karl Rove saying she might have suffered brain damage in a 2012 fall at her home, and the coughing fits, the stage had been set for full-on media and public speculation about whether there was something physically wrong with her. Many of her aides were scrambling to find out what was going on. Part of the reason it took so long for Hillary's team to put out a statement is that Abedin hadn't shared the pneumonia diagnosis with any of her colleagues in Brooklyn. Such behavior wasn't unusual. Not only did Huma keep a tight lid on Hillary's schedule, shielding certain meetings from even the most senior aides on the campaign, she also acted as a lockbox for personal information about Hillary. That left the campaign without credible information to pass on to the press about what had happened. Palmieri was pissed that they're misleading the press because Huma hadn't even told people Hillary was sick, one top campaign official recalled. It's just a Huma disaster. Those were piling up quickly. Podesta was just returning to New York when his phone started buzzing. From his cell, he jumped into the fray with the Brooklyn team to start making decisions. The first was trying to figure out what information the campaign could put out from her doctor to quell the gathering media firestorm. They also discussed whether Hillary would have to come off the campaign trail, and determined that she did. While these discussions played out, Mook and others grew deeply frustrated with news outlets that let speculation run rampant and then essentially blamed the campaign for failing to put an end to it with a quick and believable statement. It's a perfect example of the media always taking something to its absolute worst conclusion, and then it's incumbent on us to roll it back, said one Hillary aide. Then, what was insult to injury on this one was blaming us, like, well, you didn't tell us. As it turned out, Hillary was fine to continue campaigning after a brief period of rest, but she'd created questions about her physical fitness for the office. More important, she'd reinforced the public perception that she was always hiding something. She was so secretive that even her own campaign team didn't know when she was sick. Between the deplorables remark and the health scare, Hillary looked off her game just as she was starting the final sprint to the presidency. In the days after the pneumonia incident, the remainder of Hillary's lead over Trump would evaporate. On September 18th, Trump climbed to within 9/10 of a point of Hillary in the average of polls, which typically reflected the snapshot of the horse race from a few days earlier. Neither being ill nor covering it up would help her with the millennial voters who didn't trust her, didn't like Trump, and were increasingly looking to third-party candidates. To court the younger set, Hillary turned to an old rival who had inflicted great damage on her campaign, Bernie Sanders. In late September, Clinton consultants Jim Margolis and Mandy Grunwald reached out to their Sanders camp counterparts, Tad Devine and Mark Longabaugh, to ask for Bernie's time and to share the script of an ad they hoped he would cut for Hillary. Devine talked to Bernie, who was happy to keep his promise to do whatever he could to help Hillary, and hightailed it to Burlington, where he would meet up with the Vermont senator and Jeff Weaver. Devine was waiting when Bernie turned the corner in a little Chevy, a startling change from the days when he'd been carted around in SUVs surrounded by Secret Service. Everything had returned to normal. Once inside, Bernie and Devine went through a routine that had become familiar over the years. Bernie, wearing a blue dress shirt, open at the collar, sat down in a chair in the living room in front of a brown leather couch and a sun-filled window. As Devine filmed, Bernie stopped from time to time to rewrite the script in his own voice. He was okay with the main thrust of the spot. He would say Hillary was good on education, health care, and the minimum wage, and that Trump was wrong on climate change and the economy. No big deal. But the final words on the page, "I'm with her," were too much. Bernie couldn't bring himself to say them. "It's so phony," he griped. "I don't want to say that." So he didn't. But he did do a bunch of different takes, not just on the main spot, but on more narrow topics that could be used for digital advertising. In one, Bernie made the case against a vote for Libertarian presidential nominee Gary Johnson, who was an attractive alternative for many voters who couldn't stomach Hillary or Trump. Devine sent the film to Hillary's consultants. They sat on it for a couple of weeks before coming back with a request to make a few changes. A minimum wage graph should only go up to $12 an hour, not $15 an hour, and the like. And Bernie's team executed. Another couple of weeks passed before Margolis delivered some bad news to Devine. Hillary's campaign wasn't going to use the ad at all. Her consultants had asked voters what they thought of Bernie's ad. Voters liked it, Margolis explained, but some of them raised doubts about whether Bernie fully supported Hillary. That wasn't shocking, Devine thought, because undecided voters, who make it into focus groups so late in a campaign, are generally pretty scared.